replacement of the track you were talking about, My Name is Douglas, you've just had this reprise of Dreamers in Run, which is pretty lush and ornate and beautiful. And then the next thing you've got this bop, 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 bop. Yeah, who is that weirdo?
This is a test. This station is conducting a test of the emergency broadcast system. This is only a test. This concludes this test of the emergency broadcast system.
Next year, the great BMX Bandits, breeding ground for such indie greats as Teenage Fan Club, the Soup Dragons, the Vaselines, but an enduring band of wonder in their own right, turn 40 years old. And they do this in the back of their forthcoming new album, Dreamers on the Run. A concept record of sorts, kind of, not really, but kind of. The idea for the group's 13th record, I'm not including EPs, live albums and compilations, because I'll be here all day, was originally conceived a decade or so ago. That was curtailed when mental and physical health issues caught up with BMX Bandit's sole constant, Douglas T. Stewart, who I speak to on the episode today. And yet on April 26th, the band finally released said record, and I can report that it's an absolute delight. Lush, orchestral, wide-eyed and innocent. Everything that anyone who loves BMX Bandits hopes for from them, and more. Kurt Cobain once said of BMX Bandits, if I could be in any other band, it would be BMX Bandits, and they would have been lucky to have him. The music of Douglas T. Stewart and BMX Bandits has soundtracked well over half my life, and I feel very lucky to have coaxed him onto the podcast. The audio starts out a bit tinny, and I've done a lot to tidy it up, but stick with us, and I think you'll find an interesting and sometimes inspiring conversation. So since recording this episode, I have sorted out my Zoom Pro account. Yes, you can all relax now, I know you were concerned. But that doesn't mean I'm not going to ask you to consider subscribing to the James McMahon Music Podcast Patreon, link in the show notes. You get extra episodes, I get to eat and pay my bills, everyone is a winner. That said, if you wanted to leave a rating and a review of this podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever else you listen to podcasts, I'd be very happy too. Ditto if you were to pop over to the Spook YouTube channel at Spook 3 O's. There you can watch many of the conversations that have appeared on the podcast, including this one, in visual form. Coming up soon on the podcast, by the way, is a very fun conversation I had recently with one Luke Haynes, main man in the Auteurs, Bader Meinhof and Black Box Recorder, principally about his new book on the ever-great 9/8 Books, which is titled Freaks Out, Weirdos, Misfits and Deviants, The Rise and Fall of Righteous Rock and Roll. That, as I say, will be on the podcast feed soon, but if you're in London and you'd like to see me in conversation with Luke in person, the next Thursday, that'll be April 4th, I'm interviewing Luke at Rough Trade West about that book and a whole lot more. I'll put a link to buy tickets in the show notes. It'd be great to see some of you there. So nice to speak to you. I've been a fan of your music as long as I remember. I've spent a bit of time with the new record now. I got it probably about an hour ago, so it's quite fresh in my mind. But it was really interesting to sort of read a bit of the backstory that this record, you'd kind of envisaged it like a decade ago.
Yeah, I mean, and the initial idea for it came even earlier than that. But yeah, it was 2014 that initially I'd came up with this idea, and I'd kind of jumped the gun a little bit and started actually saying we were going to do shows based on this record, even though the record didn't exist yet and things.
Okay.
Then I became ill, I guess, in my head, and then that kind of led to me kind of being physically kind of ill as well, and so everything was just put on hold. And when I was able to, I started making another record with Stuart Kidd, which became BMX Bandits Forever. And it was like less of a, I guess, conceptual big thing. It was more almost like Stuart encouraging me to come along and going, have you got a new song that we could work on? And I would go along and we'd work on it for a few hours. But eventually I felt like having another go at trying to make this record that I had in my head, or a version of it I had in my head. And I'd been working with Andrew Patti, who'd played with BMX Bandits off and on as a guitarist when we were playing live. We'd made a soundtrack album together. And when I had that experience of working with him on that, and he plays so many instruments, and he's got certain other kind of skills for things like arranging strings, voices, all that sort of stuff, that I thought he's a good guy to do this project that I never quite got around to.
I mean, as someone who has had, I'm speaking about myself here, as someone who has had lifelong problems with a mental illness, I have to say that you describing ill in the head is quite a quaint way of putting it. I think I might try to use that myself from this point onwards.
Yeah, I guess, I think it's, I mean, and not in a naive way, or maybe it is in a naive way, but I think it's a generational thing. But to me, that's sort of what it feels like. It's not that it just manifests itself and said, there's usually quite a strong physical manifestation. If I'm, you know, if I've got depression, it's, you know, my body starts to ache and things like that, you know, so, or my face starts to ache and things like that. So there's a physical side to it as well. But yeah, it does feel like the part of me that's particularly not functioning properly is my head.
I mean, without being like super explicit in the lyrics that I've heard on this record, it does feel like quite a lot of the songs are about sort of almost like rejecting the real world. Do you think that's fair to say?
Yeah, but I think that's something to a certain extent I've done most of my life.
I think
a lot of creative people do. I think a lot of people are creative partly because they're dissatisfied with the world that they find themselves in, and so they want to create a sort of a better version of the world. You know, a kind of heightened version that they and their friends can kind of coexist in. It's a little bit like when, in, I think it was 1985, myself and Norman and Sean and some of their other friends started going to a club in Glasgow called Splash One. And it felt a little bit like the same thing that people like ourselves would do through music. It was like a sort of like a safe place for other like-minded dreamers to congregate and share ideas and, you know, share our dreams and encourage each other, rather than being in the place at that time. Concerts could be much more confrontational and aggressive kind of places. And nightclubs could be as well, I think, compared to what they ended up being later on. So it was a place where you kind of felt welcome, because it felt like almost everybody there were like outsiders or weirdos of one type.
Yeah,
you were amongst fellow weirdos.
I mean, I've always found Glasgow so interesting because there's so much. I mean, you know, it's the the indie mecca, really. It's certainly, if you're a fan of this music in Britain, but it's also like such a rough town, or it's such a rough city. It's got such a hard edge to it. But yet there's all this music that's come from Glasgow that's, you know, really quite innocent. And do you think that's because of how hard-edged the city can be?
Yeah, I think very often. I mean, a lot of cities across Britain And I think in America as well, where a lot of the best music comes out of, are cities of real extremes. So, you know, like Manchester and Liverpool and Glasgow, they're all cities, you know, that have got a kind of hard side to them. But they've all got, you know, something that inspires people to create really beautiful music. And I think, again, I've heard people saying, you know, if you come from a really affluent, comfortable background in a really nice, pretty town, you're not necessarily going to feel the need to create that other world.
Yeah, you know? I haven't heard a lot of great music come out of Windsor, for example.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, and there will be, of course, there will always be exceptions, you know, to a lot of people who come from that kind of places. And they do create great beauty. But I think the reason you get so many people in these kind of cities is because it's like a sort of escape, not necessarily always a geographical escape. For some people, it ends up being that, but kind of a mind escape.
Yeah, yeah, no, I can see that. I mean, one of the songs I think is most interesting is the song My Name is Douglas.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, it's a real curio of a song. It's almost like a little mini opera.
It's pretty different than the rest of the, I mean, the rest of the album's pretty different than itself, but that probably musically most.
Yeah, it's sort of the moment the sort of orchestral arrangements drop away and it's something different. I mean, are those formative experiences, do they still linger with you?
It's a funny one for me because people, when I reached secondary school from that point on, and I always had really good friends, and you know, a lot of love and encouragement from my family. But I always had people from that point on, you know, telling me I wasn't quite right, which is a phrase that's used in the song. I was very lucky. I think there's some sort of arrogance of youth thing that I had for many years where when people kind of were provoked by me, I actually kind of fed on it. I wasn't someone like I think so many people, they find that sort of thing, name calling and ridicule and things like really, really difficult. It encouraged me. You know, at that time, I was, as I say, I was very fortunate. You know, if them, you know, kind of rough guys kind of came up to me and were clearly provoked by what I was doing, the next day I would try and be more provocative.
Yeah.
You know, and kind of unafraid. And I was like that at early shows. You know, people would be throwing glasses at us and swearing at us, and I'd be saying that I'm going to give you a punishment exercise and write a letter home to your mummy and daddy telling them how naughty you've been tonight.
Yeah.
And, you know, by the end of the show, at some of the early shows, we would have to get escorted out of the back of, you know, venues in Aberdeen and things because the police would come along to make sure we could get out the back of the venue because people wanted to, you know, injure us seriously because I'd been giving it back to a certain extent in a kind of a slightly lighthearted, in my mind, lighthearted sort of a way, which the people who targeted us didn't appreciate. And occasionally, of course, I would actually get a kicking or, you know, hit over the head one time with a metal bar, you know.
Jesus.
But it's only probably in the last 10, 15 years that I've almost lost that rather misguided feeling of being invulnerable to this sort of stuff. You know, I've lost that kind of thing, and I've also became much more aware of just how much it can affect other people. And I very much always wanted part of this album. That was one of the tracks I had really early on. I wanted it to be a sort of message of, you know, we're all different, you know, but I wanted to have a kind of thing of going, it's actually okay to be in other people's point of view is not quite right, because there's other people who love you and will think that that's why you're so amazing, you're wonderful, and why you're unique, and why you're not like all these other terrible people, is because you're not quite right in the wider public or certain factions of the wider public's kind of view. And it's not like a really, really earnest song. There's kind of humour in it and things, but I just think if you tackle songs like that sometimes too earnestly, it kind of acts a bit like a repellent. People are a bit like, oh, no, this is a bit too... And I think in a lot of, films that deal with really difficult subjects and they just inject a little bit of humour or whatever, it kind of brings... It brings people in a bit more. I spoke to Robert Wyatt a number of years ago and we were speaking about this, and he was saying that for him, melody and humour are the two things that bypass the intellectual and go straight to your heart. So if you're wanting, to have a kind of strong message, a good thing to use is either melody or humour or both of them, because if you don't, it just becomes a little bit uncomfortable for people, but not in a good way. It's just going to kind of turn them off. But if you do that and they end up laughing about something, and then you slip in something or a beautiful melody, and then you kind of slip in something, but they're not as likely to be turned away from it.
It's so interesting to say all that, because I had I won't bore you with all of my sort of formative experiences, but I think that I'm fundamentally quite gooey inside. I think I'm quite soft, but I also grew up in quite a hard town and had a few things I had to navigate quite early in life that maybe kind of were difficult because I felt things so deeply. And I think I maybe kind of went the other way, in that actually, as I've got older, I've sort of tried to embrace my weirdness and my sort of individuality. But I actually realized quite early that I maybe needed to be harder if I was going to make it out alive, so to speak. So it is interesting to hear you say that you almost kind of went the other way and it was almost kind of provocative.
I did, but funnily enough.
But then I didn't get hit with a metal bar, so I avoided that.
Yeah. I acted, I guess, less typically aggressive male stereotype, but I could sort of look after myself at the same time.
right, yeah.
You know, like, you can't look after yourself much if someone hits you with a metal bar, but at the same time, and also I had the thing of generally, possibly sometimes I should have been a bit more afraid, but generally I was kind of unafraid, and certain tough people, or supposedly tough people, when they're confronted with someone who doesn't seem frightened by it, they just become disarmed or confused and a bit like, oh, a minute. No, they become a bit scared.
I feel like there should be Douglas's self-defense classes.
Very much so.
Yeah, come in tandem with some deluxe edition of this record.
I'm a fan of the music of Lindsay DePaul. The late Lindsay DePaul, and I saw on YouTube that there's Lindsay DePaul self-defense video.
Oh, really?
Right.
I was actually thinking about this last night. I was actually thinking at some point, I think I'm going to have a bit of a sort of a latter life love affair with martial arts. I feel like that might come at some point. I do like all that stuff. Tell me about the decision to record the Nora Guthrie song. I thought that was interesting to put that song where it is sequenced on the record, and obviously the rest of them are your compositions.
Yeah, well, it was, I love that. That was, for people who don't know, it was a single that was made by the daughter of, Woody Guthrie, when she was a teenager, and written by her teenage boyfriend. And I love both sides of it. The other side's very explicitly about mental illness. But that's it. Songs a bit more subtly, I think, about trying to kind of find refuge out in a park, and having to be home before dark. And the song sort of just reminded me of that sort of feeling of being an outsider, although I had a very loving family, and sometimes not always, if certain friends weren't around, feeling that you didn't really have a place to go. So, you know, it could be in the park. And because I tried to almost make like a kind of world where that song was existing in ours, which is different than the Nora Guthrie version. Ours is a, you know, deliberately kind of set, meant to be set in a kind of slightly more threatening ex-industrial kind of town, a bit more almost like the kind of David Lynchy kind of version of Bellsill, where I come from.
Yeah.
You know, where there's a kind of threatening underbelly, and like going into the park, it might be actually sometimes a little bit dangerous, but it could sometimes feel like a bit of, oh, I've got away from the main drag, I've got away from the main bit of down here, and I can just, you know, listen to the things in my own head and go away and moan little dreams.
And another really interesting song is this song Cockerel's Waiting, and it's got Joe Head from Swell Maps on. I mean, I'm going to need you to explain to the listeners what's going on there, mainly because I'm just, it's quite out there.
Well, as I've said, my main collaborator in this album was Andrew Patti, and Andrew had written the chorus of that song when he was in his teens. Now, he's significantly younger. He wasn't born when the VMix Bandits started, so he's significantly younger than me. When he was in his teens, I was a proper grown-up by that point. He had this kind of song that I think he'd watched The Last Waltz, and he had this chorus for a song, and he kind of brought it to me, and it made me think of a record that it's been a kind of quite big inspiration on VMix Bandits, but not in a kind of overt way. It's the Phil Oakes album, Phil Oakes' Greatest Hits, which isn't a Greatest Hits album. That's a strange one, because it's not Greatest Hits, it's just called Greatest Hits in a gag. And when he played me that chorus, I was like, can I play you something? And I played them the Phil Oakes track, and I went, I sort of think that that's a kind of ticket to where we could go with this chorus, and a bit Van Dyke Park's kind of travelogue thing, and the idea of bringing in a kind of almost a little kind of lullaby or a kind of campfire lullaby type song that I could imagine in a Laurel and Hardy film like Way Out West near the end, and then it returns to the start of the album as well. There's a kind of reprise of the opening track, and it was sort of meant to be the idea of this album. Partly is that these dreamers are on the run and they travel through all these different worlds, and then the opening track there's a kind of almost like a chase sequence where in my head I can hear them, you know, running across hills and valleys and sleeping on a beach and all that sort of thing. And for Cockles Waiting Again, that was sort of meant to be putting these two outsiders into this slightly a version of the Wild West, or a version of the West that doesn't actually necessarily exist and maybe never really existed. It only exists in the world of Mark Twain and Gene Autry kind of cowboy songs and stuff like that. And I've always found a kind of romance. I mean, it's one of my big heroes, I guess, is Brian Wilson, and I think he's always found a romance in that kind of material as well. So again, it's just putting us into this world, and then there's the thing of always be ready to run. So it's like we're in this thing, and then it's always be ready to run, 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 like almost like an alarm's went off. And that was, funnily enough, a half-remembered version of the film Logan's Run, which has like Michael York and Jenny Agutter as these two lovers disappearing, trying to hide from this very oppressive, modern, futuristic society. And there's times when they actually get outside and, you know, they're sleeping in these kind of idyllic, natural surroundings. But we've always got to be ready to run, 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 run.
Do you know what? I've got brothers. I've got half brothers who are a lot older than me, and I inherited a load of their annuals when I was a kid. So I was like reading about, you know, I was reading about TV that I didn't see, because it was like TV that would be in their sort of boys' own annuals. And you just explained Logan's Run to me there. I've never seen an episode, but I feel like a lot of things make sense from the articles about the TV show I'd never seen from my childhood.
I know, well, I've only ever seen the movie version. I never watched the TV version because the TV show didn't have Jamie Agutter, so I was out.
Right, yeah. You mentioned Dreamers on the Run, the first song. There's a lot going on in that song, but also, and you've talked a bit about it, but it's interesting opening with the, you know, it's almost like, you know, sorry to sort of reference Norman, but it's a little bit like on Bandwagon-esque when they open with the concept, which is like so much longer than every other song on the record. But it does set the scene for what's to come, really.
Yeah, but that was my instinct, and we would open with that as soon as it, because that was the first song that I came up with in my head. And then, you know, when I brought it to Andrew, you know, we came up with the chase sequence, which was kind of based around the melody that he had. The kind of do-do-do-do-do-do-do. And yeah, it was, at first we were going, should we put Setting Sun On, which is quite a kind of catchy pop moment? Should we put this first? And then we're like, no, let's just actually go for it. And so we very much thought of this as a thing that doesn't exist, I think, nearly as much as it used to, as an album, which was a complete thing. It is also separate songs, but it's very much meant to be a listening experience. And again, the placement of the track you were talking about, My Name is Douglas, you've just had this reprise of Dreamers in the Run, which is pretty lush and ornate and beautiful. And then the next thing you've got this, bop, 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 bop. Yeah, who is that weirdo?
Yeah.
And I like that idea. I sort of hope when people first listen, they will be like, what? Where did that come from?
Yeah.
So, yeah, Dreamers on the Run very much is like, it's like the opening titles to the movie that this album is. Because mostly when I make songs and some things in the context of albums as well, they're like kind of, they're like movies in my mind.
It's funny, I just spoke to a musician on the episode that's coming out just before this. That would have been the last episode. I just spoke to a musician called Ed Harcourt, and we were talking about that, about how he, you know, almost sort of writes his songs for movies that don't exist. It kind of begs the question, I mean, do you want to make this record into a movie? I feel like I want to watch it.
I know, well, it's a funny thing, because I'm not a movie maker. I sort of think the pure version of the movie that exists in my mind, and hopefully maybe will exist in listeners' minds, and that'll be a different movie.
Yeah.
All of those like movies of the mind might end up being purer than an actual movie that I can make. You know, it's like when they made a movie, or it wasn't the Beatles that did, but when the Bee Gees made a movie or Sgt. Pepper's, it didn't suddenly elevate Sgt. Pepper's to a great art form. Yeah. You know, the kind of the little movie scenes and things that were created by the original songs, just in people's minds by listening, were always going to be stronger. But yeah, it was an amazing time when, as I say, Andrew and I got to write the music for a movie, because that was always a big ambition in me. I think my earliest real big memory of music was the theme tune to The Adventures of Robinson Crusoe.
Right.
And that was shown during the moon landing, kind of times when they were having breaks from the coverage of the moon landing in 1969. People would have breaks and they would show The Adventures of Robinson Crusoe. And I was really pretty young then. But that music had a real big thing. And when I listen to it now, I go, I can hear bits of Pet Sounds in here. I can hear bits of Serge Gainsbourg. I can hear bits of, you know, not things that I think they deliberately were putting in for Robinson Crusoe, but it's almost like that in soundtrack music has became like a template for so much that I went on to, you know, discover and love later in life.
I really do feel like if you are creative, and I do believe that everyone is creative, I just feel like some people have the sort of the confidence to express it more or the opportunity, but I do feel like so much of being creative is like trying to serve the person you were when you were a child.
Mm. I'm totally with you on that. And I also think, you know, for some people, when they are like an artist of whatever kind, they almost never quite end being a child. Maybe none of us do, but I think we're given permission to remain that way.
Again, just referencing, this is an episode that hasn't aired, but I did an episode with Paul Simpson from Wild Swans, and we were talking about, which at some point when I have the energy to edit such an epic episode, I will publish that. But we were talking about sort of fathers, our fathers who were quite austere, and we were sort of saying that I think a lot of their frustration, our fathers' frustrations with us, was that they grew up in a time when they weren't really allowed to not grow up.
But yeah, I mean, my dad was supporting his whole family when he was 14.
Yeah, it's crazy, crazy. And it is that thing of, like, you know, you don't have to. I mean, I think actually in terms of what it sort of done for pop culture, I actually think that sometimes there is something to be said for growing up and sort of ending this state of perpetual adolescence, or, you know, the infantization of society. But at the same time, you know, we don't want to be putting kids up chimneys, do we?
No, no. And it's funny because, I've been a father twice. I've got a daughter who's just a little bit older than one now. And I am sort of able to do adult things.
Yeah.
But it doesn't mean, I think some people compartmentalize things so much and they go, okay, now I'm this, I've got to throw all of those things away, like playfulness, a sense of wonder, all these sort of things. And I don't think you do need to lose those. You don't want to lose those. These are really precious things. And, you know, I think it's a great thing if you can, you know, keep hold of that stuff, that sense of wonder in the world.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things I've always found about your music, actually. When I did get turned on to BMX Bandits from, you know, it was the next step in my progression from Teenage Fan Club. Like, I was a big Teenage Fan Club fan. And then I heard Norman talking about you, and I realized there was the connection. And I always used to, I can't actually remember what record it was, but it's the record with, like, the sort of the doll on the cover.
You're getting dirty.
Yeah, that was my big record at university. And, you know, I was in Sunderland, and it was, you know, again, a hard town. And it took me a while to sort of get there with those songs. And now it's one of my favorite records. And a lot of it was because, it's almost like you've helped me understand it a lot. You've helped me understand your vision a lot better, because where a lot of bands, I feel like they sort of look outwards, that there is a lot of looking inside the bubble that the art has created about your music. I think you're quite unique in the way that you do that.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, my mum used to, really loving friends, and my mum used to always sort of say to me, Douglas, you think too much, you know, because even as a, like, preteen, I would be kind of going, but what if this person thinks that I was actually trying to say this, but I was actually trying to say something nice to them, and blah, blah, and she's, why are you worried about this, you know? And so I think a big part of my life has always existed inside Douglas. And my older sister was the opposite. She was, you know, out on the bike, playing football, climbing trees. And still, you know, I mean, I live 3 minutes walk from the beach, and I do love being outside and, like, going down to the sea and no matter what kind of weather. But when I'm there, even if I'm by myself, it's like I'm in the internal world of Douglas, you know, singing little songs to myself and having, you know, fantasies, you know. And, you know, there's a line about, I'm dreaming all the time, even when I'm awake. And I'm very much like that. When I'm not, when that dreaming is interrupted, and it might be immature or whatever, but I don't like sometimes when I'm dragged back into the real world.
Yeah, yeah, and no, totally. It reminds me of that poster, that slogan that students used to have about growing up. It's a scam. You've reminded me to ask you, actually, you just saying that you live near the coast. A lot of the songs are bookended with this sound of lapping waves. Tell me about that.
Well, again, I think that's a sort of a reference to when my partner, Chloe, and I moved where we now live. As I say, a few minutes walk to a really beautiful beach, and it's not a kind of seaside town. It is a seaside town, but, you know, it's not a kind of bucket and spades kind of town. That kind of, the sound of water, felt like it was something that was reassuring and therapeutic. And I used to find that when I was like a kid as well, when I'd be sitting next to any water, or like when I was a teenager, if we camped near a lake or something like that, it would always feel a bit like, you're okay, you know. It's like some people listen to tapes of whale sounds or whatever. And so I wanted to almost have that as a kind of shorthand for somewhere where you're okay. So there's a kind of babbling brook and then the opening track, and then there in between certain tracks was this kind of sound of waves and stuff like that, or rippling water. Yeah, in my own personal shorthand, it kind of just represents something that's kind of going, you're all right, you're all right. Because at the start of one of the tracks, Time to Get Away, it's just the sound of the city and the kind of oppressive kind of landscape. And then at the end of it, it's the kind of the sound of the seas kind of taking over. Yeah, so for me, it's like if you go down for a walk on the beach and your head's all muddled, it's maybe not going to get rid of all of your problems, but it will probably, you'll feel a little bit less all tangled up inside.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Things do feel better by the sea. I better bring our conversation to a close because I am on this free Zoom account at the moment. This is the point in the episode where I say to listeners, if you want to subscribe to the Patreon and help me get my Zoom sorted out, then that would be fantastic. But it's been so nice speaking to you. Are you going to play these songs out live? Have you got plans to do that?
Yeah, well, we've started doing some of them already live. We're doing, I think there's about four or something that we've played live, and we'll gradually be introducing more of them. And some of them, I think we really need, like, to have string musicians and things, but next year's our 40th anniversary, so we're hoping maybe to try and see if we can put together a big one-off concert where we can do some things with a string section and maybe a woodwind section, because there's another track where there's a big woodwind arrangement going on.
Oh, that'd be amazing. I'll keep my ears peeled. And the record is April 26th.
Yeah.
Brilliant. Cool.
Yeah. Well, thank you for wanting to speak to me. I really appreciate it. It's nice to meet you.
Oh, no, an absolute pleasure. You've been on the wish list for this podcast for a couple of years, and I've just, it's not that I didn't think I could kind of get to you, because I think we know some mutual people. I know quite a lot of Glasgow musicians and stuff, but it was more like just, it's a long list, but it's been a real treat. And yeah, hopefully we'll speak again.
Brilliant. Well, it's good to speak to you. Don't be a stranger.
Well, that was episode 268. Thanks to Douglas for the chat. The theme tune's by the band Bis, and I'll see you soon.